Blog Talk Radio.
Join us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and listen to us at www.naturestalkshow.com.
Hello, everyone. This is Ken McKeon here. Welcome you to Nature's Talk Show and tonight's episode of The Fine Art of Paleontology. My co-host Ken Borman and I will be taking you back in time to the Permian once again. A little bit younger than when we visited last month, the Abbo. But before we get to that, I'd like to please invite our listeners to go to www.naturestalkshow.com and join in our live chat room. Ken, as always, is there to field your questions and also your comments as well as we talk about an interesting subject. But before we do that, as Ken, you've got some really exciting news about Nature's Talk Show coming up to where you're going to be here in a few weeks.
Yes, Ken, thank you for that. Mary, Tom, and I are going to be at the Northeast Council of Aquarium Society's 41st Annual Convention. If anyone lives out around the New England area, you've got to come to this. It's going to be a great weekend. It's the weekend of April the 8th to the 10th, and it's at Rocky Hill, Connecticut. It's a great lineup of speakers. There's plenty of manufacturers and vendors in the vendor room. There's going to be room sales. You can get just about any fish you want there. And as I say, there's going to be plenty of vendors and manufacturers in the vendor room, so you can get virtually anything you need for your fish. Come along and get it there. And you can talk to us.
Yeah. You know,
if you've got any ideas on shows or anything, come along and talk to us. Let us know. We'll also be raffling off some of Ken McKeegan's artwork. We've got some really nice paintings that he's done here, and we're going to be raffling them off. So come along and grab some tickets, support the show, and you might win yourself a really nice piece of art you can hang on your wall.
What's fun is I've included a couple of my fish reconstructions, paleontology reconstructions. So you can get you a pair of lobe-fin fishes from one of our shows that Ken and I did a couple years ago. We may have to revisit the coelacanth one of these days, Ken. Now, I had the experience a couple years ago to be a guest speaker at the NEC conference, and Ken, I will confirm that the people there are wonderful. The service was great. The hotel was fun. The food was awesome. Being a guest speaker itself was just a treat, you know, that I really enjoyed. And I hung out and talked to people and as well. And we talked about all kinds of stuff. You know, we talked about everything from fish to flowers, you know, because there are even vendors that bring orchids. So, for those vendors, like and as fish goes, Ken, they had tank raised clownfishes there, several different kinds. There were all kinds of tank raised cichlids, tank raised anabandids. You know, I mean, it was just a plethora of fish that were raised by these really awesome breeders. So, you can get some really fantastic fish buys there. You know, the NEC conference is fun, and like I said, you know, they'll get to meet you guys.
yep, and I'm always up for a chat with anyone, so come along. I'm not too hard to understand in person, even with my Australian accent.
What's fun is I can be a chatty type too sometimes. You probably all heard me get on the show here. And once we're on a fun subject, boy, it's we can get going, that's for sure. So, check Ken and Mary and Tom out at the NEC conference, and you'll have a wonderful time as well. So, with that, Ken, we're going to take our listeners once again back in time to a snapshot of part of Western Pangaea.
Yeah, it's. And we're still down in your neck of the woods, aren't we?
Absolutely. Where we're visiting tonight is called the Delaware Basin. It was a a marine basin on the western edge of Pangaea that's formed during the early Rocky Mountain orogeny here in the southwest, what was to become the New Mexico-Texas area. Now, when we're talking West Texas on this part of during the tonight's show, we're talking directly south of New Mexico. That little spur that you see that comes off the on the west part of Texas. There are several mountain ranges there. I've been to the Glass Mountains, but I've also been to the Guadalupe Mountains, camped there several times as well. So we'll be talking about that particular reef, the Capitan Reef system, on the northwestern border of the Delaware Basin.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was, Ken, the Great Barrier Reef of its day.
So you're saying it's the equivalent of its day to the Great Barrier Reef of Australia?
Exactly. Yeah, it's one of the best known of the large reef systems that developed back in the Upper Paleozoic. Now, you remember it's been a few shows ago, but we talked, I believe, about bioerms, didn't we?
Yes, we did. Yeah.
You know, a little bit about the Silurian bioerms, how they were built up of sponges and algae. Well, the composition of the Capitan Reef system and the reefs around the basin were basically similar. They were calcium-secreting algaes and different types of sponges. And these sponges and algae crustaceans weren't very large, per se. You know, so the reef itself wasn't as big, I guess, like you see a modern coral reef system. It was more flattened and closer to the seabed comparative-wise, I guess you could say. So that was the structures, and that was composing the reef. And we'll talk about those different organisms that were the reef builders and the composition of the reef here shortly. But today, what we see are the remnants of it. Now, the age of the Capitan Reef, we need to explain how far back in time we're going. We're going back to the Lenardian Guadalupian age. That's early Permian time. And it was during this particular part of the upper-lower part of the Permian and into the middle part that the Capitan Reef flourished. And the nice thing about this particular sequence here, Ken, too, is it provides the whole series of time. It is sequential. It's conformable. There are no unconformities here, for the most part, that separate up the Capistan Reef system. So you get this beautiful, beautiful series of fossils. Where we can see the evolution of foraminiferas, the evolution of the brachiopods, evolution of mollusks, the evolution of gastropods, because they're preserved in the fossil record from oldest to youngest for this particular point in time. And that's really kind of a very, very interesting.
It would be. That would be fairly rare, wouldn't it, to get such a nice transition all the way through?
It is. That's what's nice when we get these really beautiful snapshots. And, of course, that's one of the nice things here about New Mexico, upper Carboniferous and Permian marine deposits here in the southeastern part of the state, is they're fairly continuous because these basins recorded, sea basins recorded, different forms of life for a long, long period of time. Now, we do see down low, when we look at the Capitan Reef, that there is an unconformity. It's right above the what's called the Victorio Peak Dolomite in the Lenardian Age. It's called the Cutoff Formation, and it what it does, it shows that at the cutoff formation there is an erosional surface here before the Capitan Reef really got going. And that was exposed to the air for a while. So we got this here, this surface. Then the basin started forming, became flooded, and that's where we start seeing the Capitan Reef start growing. And that's just around a little bit into the Guadalupean times.
So that's much after where I go hunting up here. I go to a Devonian site, so that's Devonian's much older, isn't it?
Much older, yeah. And at any rate, when we look here, we can use the cutoff formation here. That's where we see the change in age from the Lunardian. Now, the Lunardian, let's talk a little bit about the Lunardian age here in the Permian for our listeners. Mm-hmm. If you remember last month, we talked about the Abel Formation and how it was a Sellian-Sakmarian age, okay?
Right.
And the Sellian-Sakmarian represent the first two ages of the Permian. Then we have the Lunardian age, which averages out to 280, 285 million years, like thereabouts. Actually, about 290 to about 272 is when we have the Lunardian age. Then we go into the Guadalupean age, about 272 million years. So when we're looking here at the Capitan Reef system, we're looking at an age when the reef was really going strong, from about 270 million years or so. Let's see, as we look up through the Guadalupean to approximately 260 million years. So we're looking at about a 12 million year sequence here that this reef records. Now it's, you know, that's a chunk of the Permian, but it's not a big chunk.
No, it's a substantial little bit of time now, isn't it?
That it is. And like I said, though, all these sequences here in the Guadalupean, though, are conformable, so we can record the series there. Now, when we get to the Ochoan age, or part of the Lopingian, it's Ochoan here in the western sequence, but the Lopingian age, which is the final stage of the Upper Permian from 260 to about 250 million years, the reef basically dies and becomes exposed to air as the Pangaea, western part of Pangaea, gets raised above, more and more above sea level during the western plate tectonics. And that's when we see that's what we have preserved today, the reef from its beginnings all the way to its death.
Wow. That's quite good that you can trace it all like that.
It is. It's like I said. It's really beautiful that we have this beautiful sequence here, preserving this reef. And it's interesting too because we have not only very well preserved the back reef, which is on the inside of the reef, that we also have the fore reef, which is cool, Ken, because even in the rocks that we have. we see the drop-off of the deeper part of the basin and the shallower back part. We even have that preserved there in the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really an interesting thing. And on the fore reef side, towards the where the waves were coming from, we see at the base of the reef, when it starts building up, debris start building, where we have the talus slope. And as the reef itself built and grew on the deep side, that's where we see the fore. It's called the fore slope. And that's where we see the formation of these talus slopes. And behind, we see basically where it infills. There's not near as much current as there is on the around the fore slope side. So we see it filling in. And a lot of times, the sequences behind the reef showed that it got really, really saline. sometimes so saline that we have massive deposits here in New Mexico and parts of West Texas of gypsum. I mean, massive amounts too, really hundreds of meters thick. And it makes you wonder how much, you know, this brine water got washed into these basins to fill, you know, these areas with this thick sequence of these gypsums, you know, because, and I've been to these sequences. Again,
they're amazing. Do you think that would be much the same process as what caused the Dead Sea?
Exactly. Yeah, it's
right.
Just like
okay.
That. It's once the, you know, water would flow in, but there was no outflow. Marine water would come in and no outflow. That's way behind. When we get here, start looking at the lower Lanardian age here, here in central New Mexico, the Yeso deposits. One of the very first things we start seeing is a transgression of marine water, and because we just a little ways up into the Yeso, we start seeing marine fossils, halite. Morphs, pseudomorphs in the rocks, and we even have a sequence where we found ammonites low in the Yeso. So we know that they're down in the southern part of Gondwana, that they were having the ice had basically melted the glaciers, so we had a rise in sea level. And it was during these times that these basins started forming. And here, like the Delaware Basin, that's when it started filling with water as it developed.
See, one thing did occur to me, Ken. Given that it's a very large system, you know, a huge reef, but do they mine parts of it, you know, to get the limestone to use as cement or anything like that? Are there parts of it being destroyed? I guess what I'm kind of asking.
Well, I don't think there's much mining actually going on. Now, in one of the four basin, as the four basins start dying off, we have a large formation of halite, really large formation, and they used to mine it for salt. Matter of fact, are you familiar with the infamous Whip Site waste?
What's that one, Ken?
It's a nuclear waste storage facility
down,
just south of Carlsbad. And it's where they put it into one of the salt mines. And they made it, and they've basically stored a lot of the nation's nuclear waste down there. And there's a lot of controversy about whether it'll get into the aquifer and all kinds of things that can happen. Because one of the things about salt that probably a lot of our listeners don't know in geology is salt actually flows.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah, yeah. Isn't that amazing? Salt actually, under the weight and pressure, will actually flow and move. Kind of like a glacier, except a little bit slower because of the crystal structure. But it actually
right.
will. And they're worried about the natural flow of the salt, you know, causing the containers and stuff to break open and release all this, you know, nuclear radiation into the south part, southeastern corner of New Mexico. Which I don't know, it'd be a mess. But
it would.
Yeah.
It would be.
But that formed more up into the Ochoan Age. We have the Salado Formation. Which Salado, of course, means salt. And that's the over deposit after the reef actually died. Now, when we come to talking about the reef, you know, how it grew, we have organisms that help make reefs. And the main organisms that we had for the Capitan Reef community, we have fenestrate bryozoans. Several species were involved with this here, including Polyporia, Goniopora, and Fenestella. The Fenestella is a really cool bryozoan. We also had the sphinctozoan sponges. One of those is Archaeolithoporella, and it encrusted different things. Another part of the community was microbial micrite, and that caused bioclastic sediments. And microbial micrite, what that basically is where microbes encrust sediment and parts of broken shells and stuff like that, and they put a carbonate crust directly onto these different hard structures. So they help build limestone. A lot of the limestones are actually built with microbial micrite.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do we know why there wasn't much coral there, Ken?
Well, corals hadn't really got going yet. They were still a lot of there were some corals that were communal, but the types that we see living today really had not evolved. And
okay,
yeah. So reef structures. That's why reef structures were built. All these other organisms. Now, here's something that's kind of interesting. When I was checking out some of the life forms here, do you know how common crinoids are in Carboniferous strata, especially like the Mississippian part, lower Carboniferous, and
right.
Of course here in New Mexico, crinoids are real common. Not one calyx has been identified from New Mexico Permian rocks. They find a few isolated stems, but crinoids appear to be a fairly rare life form around the Delaware Basin here. At least on the northern edge.
And there's no apparent reason for that you can think of?
Habitat must not have been right for them, I guess.
There must have been something, eh?
Yeah, the closed basin kind of thing, you know, because it was becoming closed off with just parts of it to the east there, or to the west of it, that was actually connected to the Panthalesa Sea, I think it was. I believe that's the one, Panthalesa Ocean to the west, yeah.
Okay.
And now, back when we were talking Abbo times, that seaway actually went all the way across southern New Mexico, okay? And so we had shoreline that actually went from east to west across the state line, then kind of curved back up towards the north as we hit the edge of the uplifts that were becoming part of the western Pangaea as the continent kind of moved to the west. So that's kind of, you know, and these seaways, what was happening is the shallow, remember we talked about how shallow the Abbo floodplain was, you know, it was fairly relief. And also to the east in the upper part of Texas, out across the, like Amarillo, down through where we see the Texas redbeds, like Seymour, Baylor and all those places. That's where we see all the Lenardian to Guadalupian age Texas Dimetrodonts. They come from that band that runs north and south. And we see not only in Texas, that part of Texas, but here in New Mexico, we see the seas coming and crossing, especially in the Lenardian age here. Where it warmed up, but got a little bit part of Pangaea started getting a little bit dry, and it could have been because of the size of Pangaea. Also, where we were at here in this part of the continent of Pangaea was starting to move north. We were Carlsbad and that area were probably real close to the equator at the time, right? Real close to it. And as we moved slowly through the Permian, we're moving slowly up and into the horse latitudes because we see north part of New Mexico developing in this particular period of time, these great sand dunes. Now, picture, if you will, Namib. And that's basically what we're seeing here on the western part of Pangaea, like the Namib Desert.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So, that's now, as we get close, of course, like I said, we go from the northwestern part of the New Mexico, Colorado, and we go to the southeastern corner here where the Capitan Reef is, you know, we start, that's where we start getting back into, you know, where it was permanent marine. Wasn't really subject to this you know, transgression, regression that we see. So this Permian Basin, because this is another interesting thing about the basin here, because of how it was formed, it also became a great oil trap. And we find lots of oil in these Permian rocks throughout southern New Mexico and northern Texas there, or western Texas. So, real rich.
Have they been drilling for that?
For a long time, you know. Yeah, this has been a... there's a little town, I think it's Hobbs, New Mexico, that's on the southwestern part, just a few miles in from Texas. And they do several plants that crack the oil there from that part of the state.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, of course, oil or petroleum is a natural product, too, of fossils. It's a type of fossil. And... you know, it was actually comes from living organisms. So that's one of the main reasons
area.
That. What's that?
It's a rich area.
Yeah, yeah. That's what one of the things that makes these basins like this here, you know, well, you know, sought after by petroleum companies. They try to find these areas, and because. Usually they'll find petroleum deposits. Now, let's see here. As we talk about, now there's some really interesting things, Ken, that when we look at a reef, you know, even back then, and we can take a modern reef today, and when we look at a modern reef, there's creatures that are there that we know won't fossilize, things like flatworms, things like the shellless mollusk, worms of all kinds, you know. These things were living in this bottom. Now, here's one of the things that was happening because of the way the structure of the sponges, the bryozoans, and the limy algae is it actually made the reef kind of porous. And so these porous areas would actually start filling in with sediments. So it appears that approximately 70% of the Capitan Reef Capitan Reef system is actually just infill, where all these opening cavities and stuff finally filled in with sediments. Yeah, yeah, it's kind of fascinating. Now, when we look at the algae that helped on this here, one of the most common is an algae called Tubophytes. Now, there's a little bit of conjecture on whether it's actually a type of algae at all or whether it's a precipitation of calcareous structures by inorganic processes, where, you know, because calcium carbonate will precipitate out of normal seawater. That's kind of a fascinating thing about calcium carbonate. It appears like the sea is at a point where, you know, naturally precipitates out.
Wow. Yeah. I've got a question for you, Ken. Do you ever find something as mundane as sea urchins there?
No, we really don't.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, actually, when it comes to echinoderms, for looking here at... what we have here from the state, I've got a number of species here in front of me of different things. But when it comes to echinoderms here, and matter of fact, let me see if there's a listing of the echinoderms. Yeah, kind of. Excuse me. So far, it looks like we have a few... crinoid stem plates, we do find a few echinoid spines. So I guess they are kind of common, but you don't find whole ones, I guess. So I'm wrong there.
Right.
You do find sea urchins. Spines and plates are fairly common in the marine limestone. So pardon me there.
Mm-hmm.
You can also find parts, pieces of... of a... doggone it, sea cucumbers, and also brittle stars, little ossicles and microscopic plates are present.
That'd be hard to find fossils of, would they? Because they're mainly soft-bodied, aren't they?
It's a microscopic examination, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's where having your microscope comes in handy, like we were talking about last night.
Yep, absolutely. And some of these things, some of these small fossils that when you're looking at them under the microscope are really amazing, too. You know, they got the details fantastic. Now, as we see here, crinoids are rare, but you can find some of the other echinoderms, you know, but only bits and pieces. We can work our way back here, kind of. When we look at other crustaceans, once again, marine crustaceans back in the Paleozoic are rare, really, really rare. But we do find ostracods. So we find those in the out here in the New Mexico Permian units. Actually, they haven't been well studied. So for somebody who wants to study an interesting group of crustaceans, the ostracods are available. Trilobites. As far as I know, we've only got about 3 species of trilobite here from this age of rocks. One species called Delaria, another one called Nova Amuria, and from the Yeso marine deposits here in New Mexico, we have Anisopyge, and that's the only 3 type of trilobites.
Seems like a small number to me. Would trilobites have already been on the way out before the Permian extinction? Did it just happen that that's an area that they didn't frequent because of whatever conditions?
Actually, I take it back. When I'm looking here now, I see that we had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, approximately 5 plus species. Yeah, Triprobius,
right.
Delaria.
Yeah, well, but still, it's not all that many, is it?
And they're all the same family as well. You know, we were down to 1 family of trilobites by the Pennsylvanian period. And so, yeah, trilobites were dying out.
Was the death knell for them as a group.
Yep, that was it. And the end Permian extinction, they just were not able to make it through. And their habitats were severely curtailed. Well, they lived in marine habitats, and the marine habitat at the end Permian lost around 90% or more of its species, you know, catastrophic.
Right.
As far as other crustaceans, I find it interesting that we really don't find fossils of them here in the Capitan Reef. Now, when it comes to, get to mention some of the sponges that we see. There were other kinds of sponges, too. There were large platy sponges. One of them was even named after the Guadalupe Mountains called Guadalupia. And these sponges got up to about a half meter in diameter, actually, Ken.
Wow, that's pretty big for a sponge, especially.
Yeah. And now here's another interesting one. Another one from the Capitan Reef called Gigantospongia. It formed sheet-like masses about approximately 2 centimeters thick, but they were spread out the diameters over 2.5 meters and was the largest Permian sponge known.
Wow, that's huge.
Yeah, and these were part of the reef.
Wow. See, with stromatolites...
We have stromatolites.
Would the stromatolites that were around then be roughly equivalent to the stromatolites that you could find in Western Australia today? Would you think?
Yeah, the stromatolites today, yeah, pretty much real similar. The ones, there is stromatolitic growth in the Capitan Reef. And most of the type of algae, they did secrete calcareous skeletons. There's a lot of study to be done on these here things once again. And the interesting thing about these algae growths is you really cannot tell the species without, really using a microscopic study. These, you have to do thin section studies on these. magnification a lot more powerful than a dissecting scope.
Wow.
Yeah, so there's a lot of, you know, like I said, it's a very interesting structure when we see the creatures that build it, you know, between the plants and the sponges. And now something else that was fairly conspicuous in these parts, too, are foraminiferans, especially the fusilinids. They were important index fossils in a lot of the Permian Pennsylvanian and Permian strata out here. Tritocydes is one of the species. Now, what's interesting about these fusilinids, for our listeners, is these were some of the largest single-celled organisms in the world. And some of these are the size of a grain of rice.
That's huge for one cell, isn't it?
It's huge. Let's see here. When we're looking at some of the others here, Schreigerina. Let's see here. Is that a, I think Schreigerina is a fusilinid. Yeah. You're going to love the size on this one here. 8 to 10 millimeters wide. Pseudo-Schreigerina, maybe even up to 20 millimeters wide. Yeah.
That's huge for that.
Yeah.
Would they have bred via fission, or would they have some other way to procreate?
That's interesting. Because these things build a shell. You know, they had a little chambered test, they call it, and fusiform in shape. Of course, that gives them where they got their name fusilinids, because they were like little football kind of, or little. But I don't know. That's interesting.
You'd almost have to think that they couldn't multiply by fission.
Yeah.
It'd have to be some sort of sexual thing, wouldn't it? Maybe.
I don't know. I've never studied fusilinids enough to know, Ken. So that's one thing that you got me on there.
All right.
I'll have to check that out. Now, some other small critters or fossils that we find throughout the Pennsylvania and Permian that's used for biostratigraphy, and usually for worldwide biostratigraphy, and that's conodonts. And
all right.
Conodonts appear to be tooth-like structures. Excuse me.
Thing before.
Yeah, but a conodont appears to be a tooth-like structure in a creature that was probably an early type of chordate, almost like a lancet with teeth and eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but they seem to have lived from the Cambrian.
I'd like to see that, actually.
Yeah, it's too bad they died out, I think, during the Permian. But, little things, little mouth, little big eyes on them. And they, for the longest time, conodonts weren't known what they were, except one thing was interesting about them is they shared chemical composition similar to bone. And that was thrown, the paleontologists. Like, why do they have a composition similar to bone? What can they be related to? You know, they don't appear to be related to anything like us. And then they found some really beautifully preserved fossils that showed that they actually are in the chordate family. So that's kind of fascinating.
It is.
Yeah.
Wow.
Now, you were asking about corals earlier.
Yeah.
And boy, oh boy. Only, I guess, the thing we have here, there are several genera of solitary rugose coral and some tabulate corals. But they've never been studied. So the corals of New Mexico here, especially in the Capitan Reef, is not very well known at all. So I don't think it was really a large component, because otherwise there'd be a larger mention of these particular fossils. Now,
and as you say, too, that was before the coral boom started, before they started really multiplying and getting all sorts of different species and genera and everything, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This, the reefs were built up of other type of animals. Now, the probably the largest group of animals that we find fossils of are the brachiopods.
All right, so they've been around for a long time by then, haven't they?
Mm-hmm. And the articulate brachiopods were really doing well. When we look at the number of species of brachiopods, we look at the inarticulate brachiopods, we see about approximately 3 species. When we look at the articulate brachiopods, we see around 180 estimated species that are known, but there's been a study that was put out that shows approximately 1,000 species of brachiopods.
Wow.
Yeah. So, but it's of the different the Guadalupe Mountains, and I believe some of the other, like the Glass Mountains as well. But these are part of the Capitan systems. And brachiopods are very, like I said, they're very common. Some of the groups we have, let's see here, we have orthid brachiopods. They're very common. Let's see, there are about 5 genera of orthid brachiopods. We have one genus of Dictyonellids. Approximately 16 orthotetides. I'm getting my tongue tied today. Productids number over 101 species. So we're seeing a lot of productid brachiopods. Spriffords, up to around 17 species of those. Pterobrachiolides, around 19 species. About 210 articulate genera described by Cooper and Grant. So that's a lot of brachiopods from this area. So
it is. Excellent.
Yeah, productids appear to have about 36% of the total genera, with the Orynchonellids around 16%. Now, here's what's kind of cool when we look at some of these brachiopods. There's one here, a species called Viostella irregularis, and it's got these really interesting long spines, maybe about a 3 or 4 to each side of the brachiopod. And, you know, really interesting structure to it. Some other brachiopods, let's see if I can find another one of these here. And by gosh, that is the only one that shows the beautiful spines. But anyway, there's some others too, such as, what's this brachiopod here? Thamnosia occidentalis. Oh. There's a lot of cool brachiopods. Like I said, you're just going to have to go and come out and go collecting on them to find all the different types. That's just too many for me to really go into describe. But what we do see when we look at the brachiopod types is we see fore-reef and back-reef types, some that could take the sea surge in the deeper waters on the fore-reef side and in the back-reef, some that could take the water conditions that was back there. Now, probably an interesting thing about the back reef too is, it was probably more stable when it comes to wave action as well, being having a big reef, you know, to help storm surges, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, but now our next group of animals, like I said, there's so many brachiopods. If you want to collect, the best thing to do is just find a real nice paper published by like the New Mexico Museum of Natural History or New Mexico University, UNM, University of New Mexico, where Dr. Keyes worked, that will have a big treatment of these brachiopods. Gastropods. When it comes to gastropods, the Capitan Reef has a lot of nice ones.
So you can collect them pretty well?
There's some, when we look at some of the types, we see Bellerophons, Euphromites, Euphromitopsis, Worthia, Rhodospira. These are some really beautiful ornamented gastropods from then. When we start looking at some of the conical ones, once again, these show some affinities which look like some modern gastropods. So there's a really nice number of these different gastropods you can find. Let's see, I'm trying to see which one is probably the most common. Well, like I said, gastropods. Now, here's something I think we should mention real quick, Ken, too, is that when it comes to collecting invertebrates, like in parks and things like that, for the most part, collecting of invertebrate fossils is permitted. So when you like go out to the Guadalupe Mountain area and you're around, you can should be able to pick up these fossil shells, brachiopods, corals, bryozoans, sponges, you know, because they're not governed like the vertebrate laws. Vertebrate laws, you cannot pick up any vertebrate fossils. So that's a good thing to remember. Now, interestingly enough, another group of organisms that's well represented in the Capitan Reef system, and that's bivalves. And some of these
like
bivalves,
clams and things.
Yeah, clams and things. Nuculavis, which resembles a modern type of clam. Nucula is one of the common ones. Nuculavis is also widespread across the Permian of the United States. So appeared actually back in the Pennsylvania Permian boundary. So anyway, there's those little guy, several of those species. There's some interesting bivalves. They have this really trying to think of a good modern shell today that and it's slipping my mind. But it has these horny projections along the ribs. A spiny oyster, maybe, is what I'm trying to think of. We also see pectin-type bivalves, kind of resembling the modern scallops as well. Several different types of wing shells. So, but a number of different types of bivalves are found. Now, when it comes to cephalopods and scaphopods, that's as we start rounding out our life here, there's just a small number of cephalopods, actually about 10 or so, that we find. There's one straight species, actually two straight species of nautiloid, Permian nautiloids. But when we start looking at, say, we see the coiled nautiloids types, a good one for that there is the species Coelogasterocerus mexicanum. It appears to be a really simple type, coiled nautiloid type. Now, when we look at the ammonites, we start seeing the simple sutures on an ammonite like Petrochoquia or Paratrochia Nova Mexicana, that means New Mexican, New Mexico. It has a real simple suture, but when we look at the species like Peronites hilli from the same area, we start seeing the what you could call the classic ammonoid type of sutures, the real complicated ones. And that is pretty much the flora and fauna that we see in the Permian Capitan Reef system.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's quite interesting. Now, part of that reef system, too, is I think you were saying earlier the caverns, weren't you?
One of the interesting things about limestone that we, when we study geology, is that it has this, develops this system called a karst system. Are you familiar with that system?
Yes, I am aware of that term, and
yeah,
I know what it means.
Yeah.
For our listeners, can you explain it somewhat, Ken, please?
Well, basically what a karst system is, it's where you have limestone, a bedrock, and water dripping down through the fractures in the limestone dissolves it out, and you end up with these caves forming, and these caves collapse. And so you have all these sinkholes over a landscape. A good place is like in parts of Kentucky, and where we see a karst topography where like Mammoth Cave is resulted. So anyway, you see all these sinkholes where caves have collapsed, and that is considered a karst topography. Well, the Carlsbad Cavern System is a karst topography where rainwater over the hundreds of thousands, millions of years has worked its way through the cracks and basically dissolved the calcium carbonate or the limestone that made up the reef system. And the Carlsbad Cavern System is one of the largest in North America, too, I believe. And I've been to several different parts. If you get a chance to go to Carlsbad Caverns National Park and visit Carlsbad Caverns itself, it's a beautiful, beautiful walk. You can take a hike, which is approximately a mile long. That's where you go through the entrance, the classic entrance where the bats come out.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can walk down to the deepest cavern they have, which was the trip we took. But down there they have an elevator, and you can take an elevator back up. But you see a lot of different cave flow systems as the calcium carbonate, after it was dissolved, was relayed back down. And you'll just have to, like I said, go visit these systems, because the stalactites, stalagmites, and other forms are just, you know, just truly amazing. But what's really interesting, though, is that Carlsbad Caverns actually cuts through the reef itself. And there are places where if you don't have the flowstone on the rock, where it's just the weathered rock, you can actually see the fossils in the rock itself.
Wow. That would be a great little trip to take, wouldn't it? Go through and see the see the fossils in the walls of the passageways as you're going from display to display. I guess it's a guided tour you take.
No, it's unguided. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But they got a nice path and nice walkways for everybody. So it's but they have you get a little map guide. Way back when I went there, it's been a while. But explains all the different areas and, you know, what you're looking at when you're seeing some of the major sites down in, you know, these different systems. Because some of these, you know, the way the things form in a cave is really amazing. Now, there are guided cave tours, some of the other cavern systems down there. We went on one of them. That was really fun. They took us down into the cave, and we got to turn the lights out down inside the And this was also part of the Guadalupe cave system, the Carlsbad cave system.
I did that in a cave system in Sydney one time. I was very young at the time. I was probably 10 or 11. And we went to the Jenolan Caves in the Blue Mountains just west of Sydney. And they turned the lights off down there, and I've never seen black before like it, and I've never seen black since. And
that's black with pressure, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I know what black in a cave system is like, and there's no way in the world I would want to experience it more than a few seconds.
Doesn't that really give you a new look on life that has evolved to live in these cave systems?
It does, actually.
Yeah.
And there is plenty of life that do live there, isn't there?
Actually, amazing how many life forms are in caves. You have different areas of the cave too for life. You have outer area where it gets a little bit of light, so you have bugs that can go back and forth and other creatures. You have deeper in the cave systems where it still gets a little bit of influence from outside. Then when you
we'll
get
to do
really
that for
deep
one of our
in the
shows, Ken.
What's that?
We'll have to do a show on that. One of our shows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, visit.
Life in a cave.
Yeah, it, because caves are fascinating. But when you look at the, especially like the fishes or the amphibians, you know, that have lost their eyesight and live in these cave systems. And cave systems are rough. You know, they're, it's a tough, tough environment because very little input of food for a lot of these animals. So, you know what's funny is when I lived in Indiana, I tried to find some of those southern Indiana cave fishes and never had the luck, but I always hope that one.
I expected it would be in such a place as the Carlsberg, too. It would be very much a mineral-rich environment, wouldn't it?
Yeah, yeah, the water's real highly, you know, calcium. It has a lot of carbonate in it. Usually starts out as rainwater, and has which is slightly acid, so it dissolves the system. And then what's funny is when it starts dripping down, it starts depositing out the carbonates again. And some of these things that the rock does in a cave is just these. Things are really mineral. Yeah, the mineral crustaceans, they're just fantastic. So, yeah, we'll definitely have to do that and talk about the different life forms that have developed in the cave systems over the millennia. But anyway, we're at the top of the hour.
Where our listeners can go and visit and see the fossils that are in the walls and things.
I recommend Carlsbad Caverns to anybody. You know, it's a very interesting cavern. Now, it's unlike some of the cave systems back east, like in Mammoth Cave, which still has water flowing through it. Carlsbad Cavern is pretty much considered a dry cave. We don't receive much water. The rain, the mountains, Guadalupe Mountains that it's situated in, are desert mountains. Might receive less than 20 inches of rain a year, maybe average between 10 and 15. You know, so it's really high. It's high desert on these hills, and some of the life forms that we've seen down there, modern stuff, is amazing. Now, there's another little interesting area that I would recommend our listeners to go when you're in the Carlsbad area, and that's a little place called Sitting Bull Falls. The high access to it is just a little north of Carlsbad, New Mexico, on the highway that goes north. It's about a 40-mile drive, I believe, into the Guadalupe Mountains, and it's a little bit situated, interestingly enough, a little bit on the south and west of Carlsbad. You actually backtrack, but it's a winding road through these carved mountains of the Guadalupe Mountains, and you're in the back reef system there. This is what's cool about it. When you're driving through these rocks, you're on the backside of the Carlsbad Reef. But when you go down to a place called Sitting Bull Falls, one of the cool things about it, Ken, when I was my first visit there, I got to looking at some of the rocks on the ground, and I realized what I was looking at was a collapsing cave system.
And really?
The ground was littered with pieces of stalactites and stalagmites and all these bits and pieces, and it's like, I'll be darned, we're walking on, you know, the crushed roof of a cave. And it was really cool because at Sigma Falls, it's actually a cave system that is it's dissolving out rock, depositing new rock, but it's also crushing itself backwards and moving upstream as it goes.
Wow.
So you can actually see this cave system, you know, what's like when these things start breaking up.
Well, if you're down that way at all, I guess it's only a short drive and you're there, so it's well worth, if you're vacationing down that way, to drop in on Sitting Bull Falls too then.
Yeah, it's one of the first trips I made to the area was at night with my brother to Sitting Bull Falls. There was a full moon out, and the water was reflecting on one of the pools of water at the base of the falls. You could see the Spanish bayonet plants up around the rim that looked like Indians, you know, and full moon, and in the background was the crickets and the little owls hooting all around you. And, Ken, it was awesome. It was awesome. One of the coolest experiences I've ever had was there at Sitting Bull Falls, New Mexico. So, but here's what's cool about it.
If I come down to visit you, Ken, I'll have to do that.
There's so many places to take you, you know. You're going to stay out here a week. Yeah, but interesting here, as I mentioned, now that's the back side of the reef. Now, there's a nice little hiking path up and around the falls, and you can go hiking up in the behind above the falls. But there's some really nice fossil exposures there, and I'm holding in my hand right now a brachiopod that I collected from the back reef. That is the width of my hand, and maybe... oh, well, yeah, a good, what's that, about 50 centimeters, I think. Or so, across the hinge line, you know, and it's a, one of the biggest brachiopods I've ever collected that comes from the Permian.
50 centimeters.
What's that?
Did you say 50 centimeters?
Oh, 50, let's see here, 20 millimeters. Yeah, 50 millimeters.
Oh, right.
Big. That's a half a, that's a half a meter.
American
listeners.
Yeah.
So, so anyway, you know, go to Signal Falls, visit that part of the state, check out the fossils in that area, and if you're out in this way, you're up in Albuquerque area, look me up, and check out the New Mexico Museum of Natural History as well. Ken, this has been fun.
It would be, and it's been a great show.
Yeah. Well, next time on here on the Fine Art of Paleontology, tomorrow I am supposed to go and do some exploring in the lower, oh, I guess you could say, yeah, the lower Pennsylvania period here.
Mm-hmm.
We have a series of terrestrial deposits of Atokan age. We're talking about 320, 330 million years ago. And but we have terrestrial deposits from off one of the Pedernal uplift, part of the early Rocky Mountain orogeny. And the only vertebrate fossils, if we get lucky to find any, will be amphibians. If we find a reptile fossil, it'll be one of the early, early amniotes, and it will be really a fun find.
That'll be excellent.
Yeah.
Let's hope that you do find it, and you can tell us all about it next Monday.
Yeah. All right. Well, coming up here, yeah, that's what we're going to do next next month, is visit the Sandia Formation of central New Mexico here. A really interesting time in Pennsylvania here on the Western Pangaea. Now, Ken, you, Mary, and Tom are going to be a really fun place coming up here next month, and we need to let our listeners know here real quick.
Sure. If you're around Rocky Hill, Connecticut, on the weekend of April 8th to the 10th, the Northeast Council of Aquarium Societies is having their convention, their annual convention, and it's a special one. It's the 41st. So it's been going for quite a while. So come along and have a look at all the great speakers that are there. We'll be in the vendor and manufacturer room. Drop in and say hello. Talk to us. We can talk about any of our shows. If you've got any suggestions for shows, let us know. And we'll also be raffling off some of Ken McKeegan's art that I have in my hot little hands already. I'll be bringing them along with me, and we'll be selling raffle tickets in them. So come along, support the show. All the money raised from the raffles will be going straight back into the into Nature's Talk Show. So help the show out, and you might walk out with some fantastic art from Ken McKeegan.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. All right. Well, real quick here then. Want to
don't
mention
forget,
here,
you got the better show on Saturday, Ken.
What's that?
Don't
that's right. This coming Saturday. We want to let our listeners know that Gerald Griffin will be back with Betta Time. And we're going to have to get our other host in gear so they can get their shows back here as well. So I'm about to poke and prod here, aren't I? So,
yeah, a little bit of poking and prodding doesn't hurt anyone.
Yeah, and I got a long finger, too, so. well, anyway, want to mention here, not only, to check us out here this coming weekend, we got Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. We're going to keep you busy with some great stuff. Well, Sunday, Ken, you and I are going to be talking about lawns on the green scene, aren't we?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah,
lawns.
So we want to.
Do we need them?
Yeah. So we want to remind our listeners. So, okay, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes. Go to www.blogtalkradio.com/NTS and click on the follow button for us, please. We appreciate that very much. Also, if you go to our website, we have a PayPal button, and we appreciate if you would donate some money to us to help keep our show going, too, because we are volunteers, but it does cost to keep us on the air. Visit our store for coffee mugs, shirts, and more. That helps us out. Check out and sign up for our newsletter. Please do that. We appreciate that. As we mentioned earlier, visit our chat room. You can chat with Ken, and I need to get myself in there one of these days when I'm not having a blonde moment to figure out what I'm doing. So we also, you can join us and listen to our archive shows. They're a lot of fun. As Ken mentioned, please, suggestions, let any of us know, and we do get your suggestions on the air. So we want to thank all of our listeners who have given us suggestions in the past. With that, Ken, I want to say thank you very much for another wonderful time.
Mr. Ken?
Yes?
One of our old hosts who hasn't been around for over a year, and almost 2 years, Ryan Burrows. It's his birthday today over in England. So happy birthday to Ryan, and I know it'll be very early in the morning for you now, but I don't know if you're listening, but I hope you didn't get too drunk tonight.
Yeah. Happy birthday, Ryan. And you need to get in touch with us, and we can bring you back on the show. Ryan was one of our previous guests in the past, so a nice young man from across the pond.
Yep.
All right. Well, thanks, Ken. And everybody, with that, have a wonderful evening, and we'll see you here next time on Nature's Talk Show. Nighty-night.
Yeah, it's good night for me.
Join us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and listen to us at www.naturestalkshow.com.